crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigal. We're coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel. And yet I'm also on the line via Skype with one of our writers, archaeologist Christopher Eames. He is on the line from Edstone, England. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, Brent. Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks very much for coming on the show. Chris has just written an article about Nehemiah entitled Nehemiah, A Man and a Miracle Wall. This is a continuation of his series on some of the key biblical figures and the archaeological discoveries that are associated with both those individuals and also the times around which they lived. And Nehemiah is the man that Chris has chosen to write this article about to cover the post-exilic period. So Chris, before we get into this article talking about Nehemiah, I wonder if you could just introduce the time period so that people are aware exactly where this fits into the biblical narrative.
Sure. Well, with Nehemiah here, this is during the 5th century BC. Now, if you've been following these personalities that I've been writing about, this is really the only major block we haven't covered so far. So we've done David in the 10th century, 11th to 10th century BC. We've done Elisha, Jeremiah, Hezekiah, and now we've got Nehemiah. So this is at the point during the 5th century BC. So that ranges from 500 to 400 BC. And this is after the period that King Cyrus has come on the scene. He's conquered Babylon, which in turn puts him in charge of all of Judah, all of what was the kingdom of Judah, because of course we know that the Babylonians conquered the kingdom of Judah. So now Cyrus has come in as king of this new Persian Empire. This is the major dominant empire on the world at the scene at this time period. Of course, by Nehemiah's time, King Cyrus has died. We've already cycled through a fair number of kings. And at this point in time, we're up to the time of King Artaxerxes I. His father, King Xerxes, he's believed to be most likely the husband of Queen Esther. And so we're now just after that time, after Esther's time, we're into the time of Nehemiah in the 400s BC.
So Nehemiah is a person that's quite close to my heart as well, just because studied up a lot about his life over the years. And it's just really interesting for people to realize that during the time of Nehemiah's life, as you said, he is part of the Persian Empire. He did have high position, really high office, a very trustworthy office in the Persian royal court, being the cupbearer or one of the chief security guards, really the personal security detail for King Artaxerxes. And yet he put a request in at some point to come back to this little province of Yehud or Judea, which was under the Persian Empire, because of the because of what he saw as the growing number of enemies that were surrounding Jerusalem, surrounding Yehud, and he wanted to return so that he could put a stop to that. Now, your article here doesn't just focus on the biblical narrative, though. It really does put it in the context of the archaeological discoveries as well related to this time. And I wonder if you could just talk about a little bit about if there's anything about Artaxerxes, the ruler from which Nehemiah requested time off to go and make this journey. And then also more about the political scene at the time of Nehemiah.
Sure. Well, if you look at these archaeological sources that have been coming up over the years lately, it really adds a lot of additional detail and color to the biblical story that we have, and especially so with King Artaxerxes, for example. Named King Artaxerxes in the Bible, he has been proven through archaeology specifically to be Artaxerxes I Longomanus, as his long title, Artaxerxes I Longomanus. His queen was Queen Damaspia, and it was quite a tragic way, in fact, as to how this king became king. like I said, his father was King Xerxes, the most likely candidate for the husband of Queen Esther. And Xerxes was killed by someone, and the blame was placed on his son Darius. Now, King Artaxerxes, well, Artaxerxes, before he became king, was the younger brother to this Darius. And so he saw all of this blame pointing at Darius, and he killed Darius and set himself up as king. He was thinking, I'm not going to have my older brother kill my father, get away with it, and set himself up as king. Now, unknown to Artaxerxes was that, in fact, it had been a high-ranking official that had killed Xerxes. And so when Artaxerxes found out about this, he also found out a plot that Artaxerxes himself was going to be killed by this high-ranking official. So this, so King Artaxerxes killed this official, killed his family, and from then on his reign continues. But it must have just been a tragic state of affairs to know that he had killed his brother in mistake. But anyway, that began the reign for King Artaxerxes. And he actually had quite a prosperous and magnanimous reign. The Greeks record about how kind and magnanimous he was. Perhaps this really shocking start for him made him rethink several things, made him take that into account into his rule. And we really get that feel reading the book of Nehemiah as well, because Nehemiah talks about his relationship with the king, serving him as cupbearer, receiving this knowledge of the state of Judah and Jerusalem and wanting to return there. And then he requests that time off to go and to return to Jerusalem and help return Jerusalem to a better state. And that description there in Nehemiah 1 and Nehemiah 2 really brings across a theme of Artaxerxes just being quite kind and thoughtful. And obviously Nehemiah was praying through this whole period as well that he would find favor with the king.
Yeah, it is something that we might tend to forget, but it's great that you put the context of Artaxerxes coming into power, because somebody that had this role as cupbearer would have been more trusted, the most trusted man really in the empire to the king, because he had the closest greatest ability at harming the king, and he couldn't be subject to bribes from even the family members of the king, because a lot of the time they were the ones that were knocking off their siblings or in order to reign, or even close advisors. And yet Nehemiah asked this man that obviously put a lot of trust in Nehemiah to leave, and he was worried about what he would think about that, and yet he was allowed finally to go back to this province of Yehud and act as the governor. He was going to be the pasha, as it's called, or the governor of this province of Yehud, which was at this point already established. Zerubbabel had come back over 80 years earlier. Him and Joshua had set up the temple. The temple was completed. You have the period of Esther in between. And yet the situation in Judea was pushing to a head where something had to be done to protect Jerusalem. And this is where Nehemiah comes into the story. And he is confronted by a lot of people that don't like him when he comes, that don't like the Jews. I wonder if you can talk about some of these adversaries of Nehemiah and what archaeology says about them as well.
Sure. Well, at this point in time, like I say, we've got the Persian Empire. So what you've got developing are a whole lot of little protectorates and little regions that are popping up with their own individual governors. And many of these are very aggressive against Judah. They don't like what they're seeing happening in Judah. They don't like having seen Zerubbabel return earlier to build the temple. They want Judah and Jerusalem just to stay down and to not rebuild themselves. And so one of those earlier characters that you have from one of the neighboring regions is Tatnai, the governor. And his official title in the Bible is Tatnai, governor on this side the river. And he was one of those men who asked, well, what are you guys doing trying to rebuild this place? King of Persia, these people are doing all these things. Can you confirm that they're allowed to do this? And regarding this man, Tatnai, governor on this side the river, it's an unusual title, but an archaeological discovery has been found referring to Tatnai, governor of across the river. So it's quite an interesting title and parallel of this figure who has been confirmed through archaeology. And obviously that across the river is referring to the Trans-Euphrates area. But then going into Nehemiah's time...
So that was just one second. That was from the time of when the temple was being constructed the first time under Zerubbabel. We had Tatnai, which was a powerful, powerful ruler over this province. Okay, now going to Nehemiah's time.
Right, yeah. And further on in Nehemiah's time, we've got three main figures that the Bible pulls out and states as being the chiefs of the surrounding regions, and that was Sanballat, that was Tobiah, and that was Geshem. Sanballat, a governor in Samaria, Tobiah, forget his exact title, one of the chief stewards, and Geshem the Arabian. Now Sanballat, the Horonite, the leader in Samaria, he is mentioned in archaeology. He has been proven, not just from the Bible, but in archaeology on a 5th century papyrus. And there is also a possible mention on a damaged bulla about him. Tobiah, there isn't any archaeological discovery yet that has been made regarding him. However, his name has been found. The same name has been found. So we know it is a name that was used around that time. Just we haven't found the exact person yet. And then Geshem has almost certainly been found. There's a couple of options for who this third opponent was, Geshem the Arabian. One name discovered on a 5th century BC bowl was Geshem, king of Kedar. And Kedar is a major area of Arabia, so it fits with the biblical record, Geshem the Arabian, a chief ruler during that time period. However, there's another possible candidate, Geshem of Dedan. Dedan is another Arab location. So that's the only reason why we can't say for certain which one is Geshem, although... To me and to a lot of others, it's almost certain that Geshem, king of Kedar, was that Geshem, the Arabian of the Bible. Yeah, and there's...
Sorry, go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, it's just really important to look at these characters in the context of Nehemiah's office as well, Nehemiah's role. Again, he's the governor of Judah, or Yehud, this small province, and just north of him, as you said, Samaria is the territory there, and Sanballat's there. Tobiah... as you brought out, that name is known a lot over the next 300 years. You're going to have the Tobiah dynasty, which has been recorded through history books and from Josephus, and there's other archaeological discoveries from the 3rd century BC of that family. And they were, as the Bible brings out, they were from the area of Ammon. So they're on the east side of the area of Yehud, across from the Dead Sea and the Jordan River. And then you've got the Arabians, as you said, possibly this Gashmuel Geshem being the king just south of the province of Yehud. So by getting a map and looking at these three main enemies, you see that Nehemiah is absolutely surrounded by these men who have equal rank to him. They're each governors over their own individual provinces. And it was them and this alliance of those enemies, as well as even some of the people on the coast in the Philistine territories eventually, that really caused Nehemiah to start building his magnificent wall. And we didn't actually mention this at the beginning, but it's a good place to mention right now that yesterday on the Sabbath or Saturday was the anniversary of the completion of that wall in Nehemiah chapter 6 and verse 20 something. I'm just going off the top of my head right now, but it talks about how on the 25th of Elul, this wall was completed. And this is what Nehemiah is most famously known about, completing this wall. But why was he building a wall? It was because of these other nations or provinces which were coming against the province of Yehud. So maybe we can start to talk about this wall a little bit, unless you had something to add before we got there, Chris.
Sure. Well, just really quickly, an interesting thing about this Geshem the Arabian with regards to the artifact that was found with his name. Throughout the book of Nehemiah, he's always referred to as Geshem, except for one place he's referred to as Gashmu. And on this bowl, we find the name Gashmu, king of Kedar, or this man who we're equating to Geshem of the Bible. So all throughout Nehemiah, you've got Geshem. In this one place, you've got Gashmu, and it is when it is a direct quote from a writing of Sanballat. So we can see that Geshem must have been the official Jewish pronunciation, Jewish reference to this man. But then in the surrounding areas, like by Sanballat the Horonite, they would have referred to him as Gashmu. So you can even see that correlation there in the biblical record by that direct quote from Sanballat referring to this name, which was found in its exact same form on this bowl, Gashmu, king of Kedar, same figure. And so, like you mentioned, we do have just a very prone Jerusalem at this point in time. The temple is built, but such a magnificent feat in and of itself is really sitting prone there, along with Jerusalem in general. And so you really come to understand why Nehemiah needed this wall, why Jerusalem needed this wall to be built with all these threats coming from all around them.
Okay, so before we get to that, actually, we might just take a short break, but please hang around and listen, because we're going to talk about the recent discovery in the past decade of part of this wall, of Nehemiah's wall, the famed 52-day wall that has been discovered in Jerusalem. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
This is Watch Jerusalem. Thank you for listening.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. We're talking with archaeologist Christopher Eames about an article he's written on Watch Jerusalem entitled Nehemiah, A Man and a Miracle Wall. And we're going to get into this wall right now because it is something that has been found in Jerusalem recently. So Chris, I wonder if you can just give what the Bible says about this wall and how it was constructed.
Sure. Well, most of the detailed instruction about this wall is found in Nehemiah 3. It talks about the various parts of the wall, who was building these various parts of the wall. And if you read the chapter through and study it carefully, you can see that from verse 1, it starts talking about the reconstruction from the very top northernmost part of the wall. And then it traces it as it was happening anti-clockwise, counterclockwise, all of the way around, and it points certain individuals and personalities to these various sections as they were building them, and it also points out quite significant parts of the city of David, of Jerusalem at that time, which they were building the wall around. And one of the most significant parts that Nehemiah 3 describes is a part of the city called the steps that go down from the city of David, or the stairs that go down from the city of David. And as we go through this this Nehemiah's article, Nehemiah article here, we talk about how that is most likely the stepped stone structure that was discovered very early on. Dr. Mazar was also a part of helping to bring to light the proper dating for that wall, dating it to King David's period. And this is a massive stepped structure, massive buttress, tons and tons of weight here of stepped stones, kind of waterfalling down, I guess is the best description of it, from the city of David, a massive stepped stone area, as it is called by her and by those who excavated it before her. And so this, it seems quite obvious, must be these stairs that go down from the city of David, such a massive stepped construction that survives to this day. And so we can start to look around the stepped stone structure then, the stepped area, and think, where are our sections of wall that we are dealing with? Is there anything here that belongs to Nehemiah's time period, to other time periods? And if so, we can look in Nehemiah 3 and we can deduce who was building around these stairs that go down from the city of David. And we can even start to form an idea of which were the individual personalities who are perhaps building this specific section of wall.
Yeah, so Nehemiah 3, as you said, is really a critical chapter that does give more insight into the geography of Jerusalem and the walls than any other chapter in the Bible, really. And it's very helpful if we knew where these locations were, that it mentions Nehemiah 3, the different gates. It would help us with the geography of Jerusalem and understanding that. But as you brought out, one spot is this stepped stone area that it talks about, or these stairs. And interestingly enough, I was had the chance to excavate this area of the Palace of David. We have in Nehemiah chapter 3, it talks about the sepulchres of David. It doesn't say the palace necessarily, but once you go to chapter 12, when the wall is complete and there is two groups of men are walking around the city and they're dedicating the walls to God, basically, and thanking him for allowing them to build this, it does mention the palace or the house of David instead of the sepulchres, interestingly enough. Well, here we were excavating this area back in 2007, and right on one of the walls of the palace, the very eastern wall, just above the stepstone structure, me and another member of Herbert W. Armstrong College were called in because we actually couldn't get back to the United States for a while. And we had to help. We didn't have to help Dr. Mazar, but she asked if we would like to help her as some of the laborers on part of a wall that was attached to the palace on the eastern side, but that was falling down. It started to break down. This wasn't dated to David's time. Initially, we thought this wall was from the Hasmonean period, a couple hundred years after the period of Nehemiah. So in no way were we, or even Dr. Mazar, looking to find Nehemiah's wall or part of Nehemiah's wall. Maybe we should have been, considering the geography and considering that that's kind of what the Bible says, that it should be somewhere here. Nevertheless, there is this tower that was attached to the Eastern Palace wall that was starting to crumble. So we had to start excavating it and try and find, as we took layer after layer down of this wall of stones, that we would hopefully find an area which was strong and that we could rebuild after we reinforced it, rebuild this wall to make it look like as it looked for the past 2,200 years, as we thought. But as we kept on taking away layer and layer of stone, we couldn't find a firm, compact layer in which to build upon. It actually became more and more disjointed, part of this wall. Eventually, it got to the point that we reached the bottom of the wall. And this is significant because after we got underneath this wall, we could excavate virgin soil that hadn't been touched since the very beginning of that wall's construction. And this actually allowed us to get a good date for the wall. We actually could find the period in which this wall was dug from the material that was directly underneath it. And what's interesting is, you probably guessed it by now, but we found that the latest possible pottery that we found there underneath there was from this Persian period, from the late Persian period, from this period of the biblical king, not king, sorry, biblical ruler of Jerusalem, Nehemiah. So what started as kind of a salvage dig, a couple week dig to try and reinforce an ancient wall, ended up turning into the discovery of Nehemiah's wall. And again, that's important because up to this point in Jerusalem, there hadn't been much. There hadn't been much at all that had testified to the existence of this wall. The Bible talks about it. You say Nehemiah, and what do people think about this wall that was built in 52 days? Well, it hadn't really been discovered yet. And yet in 2007, we weren't looking for it. And yet that is what appeared. And so I think people, you can go to this article and check out a couple of pictures that will hopefully give you an indication of where this wall was. This wall itself, as the Bible brings out, did really retrace the biblical period wall from David's time, which David even retraced the biblical period wall from the Jebusite time. Of course, the city expanded during Hezekiah's time, which we talked about on the show. But Nehemiah kind of retraced the original city of David, which would put his wall right by the palace of David. And that's exactly where we found it. Okay, Chris, so I want to get back to you instead of talking too much about this. What else can you tell us about the end of the book of Nehemiah? The wall is finished. I guess it goes through the first six chapters, I think, talk about the wall itself. But then we get into Nehemiah chapter 8, and we have Ezra appearing on the scene, really, for at least in the book of Nehemiah, for the first time. How does Nehemiah chapter 8 look to be confirmed also from archaeology?
Sure. Well, Nehemiah 8, we talk about the wall having been finished and the Jews coming together just after this has happened, and there's a renewed sense of purpose and dedication to serving God that they'd gotten away from. The destruction of Jerusalem had happened, the captivities had happened, and now they wanted to return to God. And so at this point, Ezra comes on the scene, and all the people are gathered at this place called the Watergate. And he opens up the Torah, the Book of the Law, and begins reading to the people and begins the instruction process to the people. Now, what's interesting about this location that they were at is this Watergate has also quite likely been found through archaeology. There's a massive gate, a massive tower gate that has been discovered slightly further north of the steps that go down from the city of David, the stepstone structure, and it has been named as the Watergate. And if we look in Nehemiah 3 and we trace that section of wall up from these stairs further up onto the Ophel area, we see descriptions of a few towers, and one's the tower that lies out and another is the great tower that lies out. And there's also the name there, the Watergate. So perhaps that refers to one of these towers, or perhaps it's a separate one. But nonetheless, you have this massive tower gathering point for the city that has been found, and that I believe that was found in the late 80s, and ever since it's been on and off excavated by chiefly Dr. Mazar, and she's labeled it the Watergate, and it certainly seems to fit within that biblical description there as sitting on the Ophel. It's smack bang on the east side of the Ophel there, massive gathering place for the people. And so it really helps put into perspective and helps you to imagine the scene in Nehemiah 8, where you have all of these people gathered together in a big area where Ezra is able to set himself up and address all the people from the Watergate area. And again, if you check out the website, there's some pictures of this Watergate that has been discovered. Absolutely massive construction. And unfortunately, most of this Watergate goes beneath a quite major road cutting through Jerusalem. The outline of this gate has been discovered long ago by an excavator who dug a tunnel all the way around and traced it underneath the ground. Unfortunately, they've laid a road all along the top of it, so most of it can't be exposed. But however, you can still get a sense for the size of it and for the amount of stones and the massive construction here from these pictures. So from this very location, talked about in Nehemiah 3, then talked about in Nehemiah 8, you have these people gathering together, coming to relearn the Torah, relearn the law of Moses.
Yeah, so in every way, as you've said, I mean, from this account in Nehemiah, and even in the book of Ezra, of course, the story of Nehemiah just continues on from Ezra. These are the very last books of history and prophecy that are written in the Old Testament. Of course, the book of Chronicles was written most likely by Ezra himself, and that might have been the reason that Nehemiah had to show up on the scene to ensure that Ezra could do his important work of canonizing the Bible. And yet, with this story of Nehemiah, as you've described, in the finishing of this wall and then standing up before the Watergate, that's where the Bible really ends. Or we know that Nehemiah comes back for another stint and has to deal with some problems. But really, that's where the Bible ends, somewhere around 430, 428 BC. And as you've, I think it's fitting that you have covered this in your last article on this subject of looking at the Bible and looking at the different biblical periods and finding out how archaeology fits or how archaeology can confirm the scriptures in these different stories. And I think once you get to the Persian period and you're talking about Zerubbabel, you're talking about Ezra, you're talking about Nehemiah and a number of other chief rulers of the returning Jews, you see even greater correlation. You see the Persian Empire and the Jews working together in some instances to rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, and there's more information out there that proves this as being accurate, to the point that nobody really disagrees that Nehemiah was a governor and that he went back to Jerusalem to build the wall. We have the wall. We have all the other rulers that are mentioned in the book of Nehemiah. They have been discovered as well. Right at the end of this article, Christopher Eames, who I'm talking to right now, says this. He says, "We no longer just have the biblical account. We have a growing archaeological account giving evidence for a number of contemporary figures such as Artaxerxes, Darius I, Darius II, Tatnai, Sanballat, and Geshem. We also have accurate descriptions of regional politics, places, and buildings, and we even have a portion of his wall." So, Chris, I do want to thank you very much for putting time and effort into writing this. People, this is the anniversary, or yesterday was the anniversary of the construction of Nehemiah's Wall. I think it was the 2400, it's in your article somewhere here.
2461st
anniversary. 61st anniversary. Yep. That was yesterday. So it's high time for you to read up about Nehemiah. He's not just a figure of the Bible. He's also a figure of history. Thank you very much, Chris, for taking time to write this for us.
No problem at all. Thank you.
That's all we have time for today on Watch Jerusalem. If you'd like to send us some feedback, please go ahead and send us emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Thanks again to our guest, Christopher Eames. You've been listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.